Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I am Christian Corley. With me, I'm pleased to say, is James McLean.
Yes, Christian is pleased.
I am pleased to say, because we haven't chatted for a while, have we?
No, we haven't.
So, what better way than to get together and record our chat and share it with the world?
Yes.
Okay, so we're talking...
people do it with their sexual moments, so we will do it with our oral ones.
Right, okay. So, yes.
It's the nature of the internet.
Possibly, yes. We are...
You expose yourself.
There is some exposing, yes.
Digitally expose yourself. Yes. And yes, in any way. But that's what we're doing.
In many ways, a lot of it's subconscious as well. But that's going into a completely different area of privacy and surveillance, which... that's not what this podcast is about. This podcast is about Doctor Who. Oh. It's a sad podcast on this occasion because we're going to discuss three recent passings: Rodney Bewes, Peter Wingard, and Jeremy Wilkin, who have all worked on Doctor Who and have obviously done a number of other things as well. Rodney Bewes, first of all, died back in November. He passed away on 21st of November. Doctor Who is largely memorable, kind of for him, really. Although he was a big star in the 60s and 70s in The Likely Lads, and Whatever Happened to The Likely Lads, which is another conversation entirely. Although I have stumbled upon this kind of... There's kind of it's like New Who versus Old Who, sort of rivalry between fans of the shows.
I'm surprised. I thought there'd have been no arguments on that, but...
Yeah. Yes. That happened. Personally speaking, I prefer the film. Anyway, Rodney Bewes, who was a Yorkshireman, so I'd stick that in there, appeared in Resurrection of the Daleks as, is it Stein?
Yeah, Stein. It was Stein, wasn't it? Yeah.
In 1984, which is the, it's a funny one, Resurrection of the Daleks. It's one of the rare Peter Davison episodes that stayed with me for years and years and years. So when I actually came to rewatch it on VHS back in the day, although of course that really only means that I only sort of, it only stayed with me for sort of like, you know, 10, 12, 15 years perhaps.
And that's the scary thing about time dilation.
Yeah,
isn't
it? One of the most, there's a lot going for Resurrection of Daleks. It's not perfect by any means, but it's got a lot of big names in it and it's fun. Despite what Tegan says.
I quite enjoy it, but the last thing I describe it is fun.
Oh, well, perhaps you're not sat there going, oh, isn't this great? But it's engaging, it's entertaining, and it is good Doctor Who, I think, ultimately. Although there are a few, bad dialogue choices. Not least for Mr. Bewes, whose, character Stein, he's under sort of Dalek mind control, isn't he? And when this control is broken, leads him to utter that famous line. Do you want to do it?
Well, poor old Stein, he can't control the confusion in his mind. This sort of sounds like a sort of Beano character, really, doesn't it? Dalek Stein.
Can't control the confusion in his mind.
Yeah. And each time he sort of has some conundrum in the strip where the confusion just gets too much, like, I don't know, in a shopping market and he has to buy between some pop or some chocolate.
This really should have happened, shouldn't it? Shouldn't this really have happened?
I'm surprised, well, not surprised because it's very nuanced, but it's the sort of thing that Viz would do if they were that nerdy, but... Yeah, it's a very weird line. I mean, his performance throughout the rest is fine. I would say it's not brilliant. I don't feel he's either entirely comfortable or he's particularly well directed. I'm not sure which it is. But that line is one of those moments of something's really gone wrong here. And he just can't make that work. And to be fair, it'd be hard for a lot of people to make that work.
Yeah. I mean, there's other big names in there, and he kind of stands out, really. Because, you know, there's Rula Lenska, who was a big star at the time. Morris Colborne, who was a massive star at the time. And it's just before Howard's Way, isn't it, though? So not massive, maybe. Leslie Grantham as well, who wasn't yet a massive star.
Yeah.
So he stands out partially because of that line, I suppose. I always find it interesting. There's this this big thing about Rodney Bewes, isn't it? About how he and James Bolam didn't get on.
Yeah.
Which
we're now going to the Likely Lads. Yeah.
Yeah. With regards to the Likely Lads, and they, you know, worked together on two occasions with that thing, and a movie as well, and then apparently, supposedly, fell out. But then, isn't that a strange thing? Because it got to the stage, really, where, you know, Rodney Bewes would talk to newspapers about his relationship with James Bolam. That's not really the sort of thing you want to define your career about, is it?
I don't know. Maybe it was something that at least defined or, you know, promoted his career, because it got him... I suppose it's the equivalent, as we were just talking about, the Radio Times clickbait. It's actor clickbait. It gets you the article. Maybe that was why it keeps his name in the news. But yeah, I mean, I read about the Likely Lads ages ago, and I remember being a little surprised by that. And there was a suggestion it's more Bolam than him, but I don't know. But then again, that's what he would say.
Well, yeah, yeah. That's Rodney Bewes, who sadly passed away in November, age 79.
Not horrendously old.
Not horrendously old. No, it's a good innings, I think. It's a good innings.
No. 79's not a good innings. He could have gone a little longer. I think I'd like to think people get on a little longer than that. 79's still quite young. It's not David Bowie young, but it's... I still think these days it'd be nice to get it longer. Yeah, I mean, it's worth a rewatch if you haven't rewatched Resurrection of the Daleks. It's as you say, it's a weird thing. It's not fun. It's very sort of brutal and nihilistic. And
yeah, you're right. It's not fun's not the right word. You're absolutely right.
But it certainly is one of the. I think it stands up because it doesn't pull any punches, and that works, as you said at the very beginning, with it being Tegan's departure, and gives her a very good reason to have a sort of departure that you just don't tend to see.
Yeah.
Where they just say it's just not fun, because it wasn't fun. And as we've said many times in the new series, it's kind of nice to see that, someone acknowledging that these adventures are pretty horrible, and eventually you just want to have enough. Because I think pretty much everyone dies in Resurrection, bar...
Lytton,
and yeah, his colleague at the end, who head off as policeman. And it was also very famous as well, partially famous for the criticisms of using the police again, like with Terror of the Autons. Which I remember as a kid, I did actually find a little unnerving. So I'm not saying they shouldn't have, because I think it made it good television, but I remember as a kid I did find the use of police as antagonists quite unnerving. And also that the Daleks had teleportation, they had corridors that could go to different levels. Because I think by that point as a kid, that whole thing about Daleks not getting upstairs had started to really saturate into popular culture.
Yeah.
So I remember as a kid being quite shocked at the fact that they could actually, they didn't need to get up the stairs because they could just appear on any level they wanted to. And that was quite unnerving. Funny as a kid that you'd think, wow, they've now got technology, they can go to any level they want to. But they've got the technology to get up the stairs. They bypassed that bit. That was too difficult.
Well, this isn't a thought I had as a child. As I grew older, I thought, well, they don't really need to go upstairs, do they? They just blow the building up.
Yeah, I thought that when I was old. I thought, yeah, if you have an issue, that's the beauty of the Daleks, isn't it? It's as if there's someone in that city who's a problem, you just destroy the city.
Yeah.
Move on. And there's that sort of brutality, which is... they don't really do enough of in the show because it is so brutal, but I am in a sense I'm surprised the new series hasn't done it, because it's a very good way of instilling their power again.
Yeah, yeah.
You have an opening scene of some rebels on a planet and they just destroy the planet. You know, that's a real big way of sort of saying, you know, you do not want these people coming.
Does that not take us to Star Wars Rogue One and the use of the Death Star in that? Is destroying the planet actually overkill? Just destroy, you know, that city or whatever.
Well, yeah.
Because that's what makes that Death Star in Rogue One. You already know what the Death Star does, don't you, by the time you see Rogue One. So the fact that it's actually got it's slightly lower power, and it doesn't actually destroy everything. So what it does destroy, there are survivors, or there are people witnessing the destruction and they can't escape from it, makes it more powerful, doesn't it? As a force.
Well, it's a funny thing, because the Death Star in the original film, because the original film is set up more as a fairy tale, and it sort of has that sort of, well, okay, it does cause a mass genocide and destroy a planet, but because you don't know anyone on that planet, because you never visited that planet, the destruction lacks any core emotive power. And Leia gets over it fairly quickly as well, brash thing she is. But so I think what was clear with Rogue One is it re-articulates what the Death Star, from being this sort of big baddie thing which has got to be destroyed, this big Bismarck, essentially, isn't it? It's the Bismarck, and then actually shows you it in action and just shows you what a horrific thing it is, and that it got more than one shot at being a horrific thing. So yeah, I think Rogue One's really interesting in that way. It sort of re-articulates the Death Star into something, really quite horrific.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
So who else we got?
Okay. Yes, it's a death list, unfortunately. Mm. In fact, I've built this as a podcast with a K, haven't I? But really should be a Beyond Casterbus, I suppose, because Peter Wingard, who has done a Doctor Who, but he's more well known for other things, passed away.
Yeah, Planet of Fire, wasn't it?
Planet of Fire, 15th of January. And, of course, he's Clytus in Flash Gordon. And if you're a fan of Flash Gordon, we've dedicated a podcast to that fantastic 1980 movie.
Mm. There was this year, actually, Sam J. Jones made some rumours of being in talks of actually doing a sequel to it now.
Really?
Yeah. Whether that would happen. These days, who knows? It could happen these days. And it's one of the few wonders of being in this era, and we have to stress these days there are very few. But the potential of bizarre reboots is one of them. They do happen occasionally.
Well, Lethal Weapon.
Yeah. Well,
that is a bizarre idea to turn into a TV series.
Yes, that's what I mean.
And yet, it's reboot, really but... good. It's not. I mean, it's not deep or anything like that. But what it takes from the films, and then adds another dimension to it. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I've been watching it. It does it really well, and it looks like it's going to get a third series. So they're doing something right.
You can do some quite amazing things, and you can do them in quite clever ways. And I saw a couple of weeks ago, I saw Jumanji 2 at the cinema, and that has some very nice little ties to the original without actually falling back on the original, or so it sort of makes it sort of its own thing, but with a sort of slight canon nudge, which is not required for anyone who's not seen the original, which I think was beautifully done. So you can tailor, and you can make interesting. Even I know it's obviously of debate, and we've talked about it, but even if we go to Star Wars again, I would still say that the fact they've managed to return it in a way which still makes it popular, that still gives it critical acclaim, still moves it onwards, but still revisits the past, whether you like that or not in the form it's in, that's up to you. But again, you're seeing these sort of pockets of returns which people are interested in. And the fact people have tension with the new Star Wars is because they want to see old Luke Skywalker. And you think, well, has Flash Gordon now sort of got that sort of cult following that there would be enough to do a Flash Gordon with an older Flash Gordon? Maybe not as a central character, but...
Well, why not? Why not take the Mr. Holmes approach?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And again, it doesn't have to be a cinematic release, depending on whoever's got the rights to it. I mean, Netflix becomes a very powerful driver for doing interesting narrow band stuff that could be good, but doesn't necessarily have to be there to sort of get this widespread box office. Because there's no doubt, with Star Wars, Flash Gordon has got quite a strong cultural memory now.
Yeah.
Especially in Britain.
Especially if they... that's a strange thing, isn't it? I think... I've never really understood why that was. I suppose maybe some of the casting has something to do with it. And the soundtrack.
The soundtrack and the casting, echoing a lot of British, as you say, they were pretty fairly famous. Brian Blessed certainly had a...
Oh, he was. He was very famous at the time, wasn't he? He was post-famous, yes. In fact, wasn't he?
But as we've said before, it is in a lot of ways. It's a good film. Yeah, it's a flawed film, but it still stands up on its own for being its own thing. And it's quite a dark film in a lot of ways. There's a lot of British elements to it, and it's got a bit of a cult following. And as I've said before in previous podcasts, it does actually carry a lot of the flavours of the original news strips, which I think is kind of interesting too.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Do watch it, and I'd be very interested in seeing that. But Peter Wingard in that is we'll talk about Brian Blessed, but Wingard had some British legacy to him, and he's excellent in that as well.
He is very, plays it really well, very sinister. You wouldn't know it was him, would you?
Well, no, because he never takes the mask off.
Exactly,
didn't
yeah.
Was there a thing about him saying that he didn't want to take the mask off, or was that? Or was he not allowed to? I remember there was something about
the
mask.
Yeah, there was, yeah, yeah.
Did he want to take the mask off and they said no?
I can't remember now. I think maybe there was a... Wasn't it something about him taking the mask off and it'd be a surprise for everyone, but they vetoed it or something like that?
Yeah, it might have been something like that. But it was an interesting case where, you know, you had this character which had quite a lot of British capital, and he stays beneath the mask the whole time, and it's his performance that plays out. And again, I think that's what's clever about it. It's not like... you know, the Batman performance where they say, well, you know, the Batman performance is hard because you only have half a face to operate with. You know, there you've got like even less than C-3PO in a large sort of way because, well, I suppose you've got more than C-3PO, but it's that same sort of thing where you are, it is really your voice and your body language which carries it. There's not much else there to carry it. Mm. I suppose his eyes, but.
There is a certain campness to the performance, but at the same time, there's that sinister element that you didn't get with his more popular role of Jason King.
Yeah, he plays it up, but he plays it up in an appropriate villain. He does carry a certain amount of malevolence to him.
Yeah, oh, definitely, yeah.
He's really good. He works well with Sido as well. And yeah, it's great performance.
So he's in... he was in Department S, 1969, 1970, and Jason King, the spin-off, 71 to 72. Now, I didn't know this, but apparently this was... a major influence on Austin Powers.
Jason King?
Yeah, I just assumed it was...
Like a Bond.
Yeah, really.
And Kane, obviously, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, that surprised me when I saw that written down.
It made me amuse the other day. I was talking to a colleague about this, and we were talking about James Bond and Spectre. And it's funny how you get those sort of... reversals, and one of the issues with Spectre and its absurdity is that it starts to mirror Austin Powers' Goldmember by setting up this ridiculous legacy between the Blofeld and Bond character, which goes through into their families and intertwines, which is exactly the lampooning that was played out in Goldmember, you know, 20 years earlier,
yeah.
Which was a lampoon of that franchise.
Yeah.
So it just shows that, you know, eventually when you start becoming so embroiled in these texts, to the point that they, you know, you're sort of reinventing them and reinterpreting them and reinventing them that they start.
Well, that's the thing about the Craig Bonds, isn't it? They're about Bond.
Yes.
So it's kind of inescapable, I suppose. But yeah, it's a astute observation. I haven't watched any Austin Powers for a long time, so I wouldn't have noticed that.
No, I watched Goldmember about a couple of years ago on Netflix, and I actually really enjoyed it. At the time, I was a bit, wasn't
sure. Third one?
That's the third one.
Yeah.
There's some nice moments in the third one. And the Goldmember character is particularly quite clever. So, yeah. But that's interesting how we see those. But Wingard in Planet of Fire, if we go back to Doctor Who, is... I can't say it's particularly memorable, but then the story itself isn't very memorable, apart from the bits which are, if you know what I mean. The Master, Chameleon, Perry are memorable, but the actual... the rest of the stuff...
This is when they shot abroad, isn't it?
Lanzarote. Yeah, yeah. And it's the Turlough's home planet bits, which are just not really memorable. Nothing seems to particularly happen in that sort of way. Quite Pertwee-esque in that sense. There's a lot of backwards and forwarding with people who distrust the Doctor or, you know, believe in the Master. And it just goes nowhere. It's a funny thing. And so his time in Doctor Who, it's not his fault. I don't think there's anything wrong in his performance. It's just not a very good story.
Yeah. It's a funny He was 90 when he passed away. He had a very unusual...
Good innings, yeah.
He had an unusual background in that it appears to be completely muddy. He claimed he was born in Marseille, but he may not have been. His original name was perhaps Cyril Louis Goldberg. Author J.G. Ballard, I'm reading from Wikipedia here, with whom he endured the Japanese internment camp in Lungua, said that he and his family knew Wingard as Cyril Goldberg in Shanghai during the Second World War, but in interviews, Wingard denied knowing Ballard. So, it's all very bizarre. So, in fact, his actual date of birth isn't entirely certain either.
Curious.
It is curious, yeah. Nothing much we can do about it, but it's certainly worth reading into, having a read and finding, just making your own conclusions on that. So, yeah, Peter Wingard sadly passed away on 15th of January. Now, we do have one more sad departure from the world of television and sci-fi and culture, and culture is not the word I wanted to use there, but sci-fi and cult TV and that sort of thing, but an actor with a sort of a wider sphere than just those things was Jeremy Wilkin, English-born Canadian actor, best known for appearing probably in some Gerry Anderson stuff. He was the voice of Virgil Tracy.
I didn't know that.
In this, not all of Virgil Tracy. The original voice actor was David Holliday. So he was the second series Virgil Tracy, but he's also Captain Oker in Captain Scarlet.
Yeah.
And he did some UFO live action, and he also did some Joe 90 in Secret Service. And he's in The Spy Who Loved Me as well.
Yeah.
As Captain Forsyth. He's out on the boat on one of the kidnapped ships, I think. To Doctor Who fans, he's well known as Kelman in Revenge of the Cybermen.
Yes.
From 1975. But he's also in the is it the first episode of Blake 7?
Yeah, he plays Dev Tarrant.
Yeah.
Not the Tarrant, not the Del Tarrant. No. Not the Dev Tarrant.
Yeah. Lots of Tarrants in Terry Nation, isn't there? I sometimes wonder if Chris Tarrant is a Terry Nation character.
He probably isn't.
He probably isn't.
Go with that. Yeah. But yeah, no, he's good in he's good in Revenge of the Cybermen. If we go to the Doctor Who point, it's an episode which in some ways is memorable, but its components aren't perhaps perfect. But his role in it is, you know, as a character actor, he comes in and he does a very good job.
Yeah,
he does what he's meant to do. He plays the part, which is quite generically Doctor Who. Human collaborator villain thing, which goes through the standard motions of that role, but he does it well, and I find him very memorable in that part. I quite like Revenge of the Cybermen still.
It's a strange one. It's got good visuals, but no, that's not the right word, is it? It's got striking visuals, some for the wrong reasons, such as the planet.
Yeah, landing. The planet perhaps is odd, but I mean, at the same time, I think, while they may not necessarily be scary, I like the aesthetic of the Cybermen in that. They're not just tall, but they look well built. You know, you wouldn't imagine messing with them. It's the first time they sort of start showing emotion really as well, which is fairly amusing as well. Mm. And even the Doctor's had remarks on it at one point. But I mean, it's got some nice set pieces. I like the redressing of the Ark. I think that's fun.
Yeah.
The Cybermen, I remember as a Cybermats as a kid, I felt was quite creepy. So for kids, I think that was fun, having the Cybermats.
It's interesting, the Cybermats. I think the Cybermats work really well, whereas the whatever the things in the Neil Gaiman Cyberman episode are called, so Cyber Nanite, something like that, they're too powerful, aren't they? They're just, you know, there is only conversion. There is no risk. There's no fear of conversion. There's only, you get in contact with those and you've been converted. It's like the thing with the, I think the similar thing with the Daleks. with their nano things, it's it just takes away the fear, doesn't it? There's no building creeping fear from them, whereas with a Cybermat there is.
Yeah, I think the Cybermats in Revenge were actually quite nicely built as well. I mean, I know they're not the classic design, but the classic design really, I don't know, isn't that impressive. It's fun, it's iconic, but I think the fact that the way they leap and the way that they're actually quite big as well, so you could imagine having weight behind them as they try and poison you. They're quite malevolent, and I like that. They're more malevolent than the Cybermen, who, as I say, don't exactly instill fear, even though they're just quite nicely and quite neatly designed. And yeah, so there's a lot of good things in Revenge of the Cybermen. As I say, I think Kellerman is great for the first, you know, the first part or so, where she's all set on the Nerva Beacon. He plays the collaborator villain nicely, who then turns out later to be a double agent. And there's lots of fun with him. You've got if we talk about the confusion in Rodney Bue's mind. You have in Revenge, you have the lovely Harry Sullivan is an imbecile line, which is probably one of the most brilliant little moments of Tom Baker in Revenge of the Cybermen. When, for those who don't know, his companion Harry is about to undo a booby trap bomb from his that's attached to him. And it's a good show. And the Blake 7 for Wilkin is quite a good one as well. As we said, it's the pilot. Well, not the pilot. There was no pilots. It was the first episode, The Way Back, where again he plays a malevolent. Arguably, you could call him a collaborator. Certainly a double agent.
Yeah.
So yeah, he plays a double agent again, and again he plays the job well. So yeah, quite a memorable character actor.
Certainly, he retired in 2002.
Right.
So he kind of stopped working there, but he's passed away on 19th of December. But it was only announced recently, wasn't it? In the past few weeks.
Yeah, it was past few weeks. I saw it flag up.
Yeah.
87
when he passed away, yeah. Jeremy Wilkin, yeah. Why don't you, dear Doctor Who / Cult TV / Cult Movie fan, join with us in commemorating the lives of these three actors. Why not check out Resurrection of the Daleks for Rodney Bue's, Planet of Fire for Peter Wingard, or if you prefer, Flash Gordon, and Revenge of the Cybermen, or Blake 7, The Way Back, for Jeremy Wilkin. It kind of concludes this rather somber podcast with a K. James and I will be back next week with more. Until then, it's goodbye. When I say more, I don't mean more deaths.
Well, there will be more deaths.
Probably.
But whether we mention them or not.
Yeah, that's another thing entirely. But until then, it's goodbye.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.